Welcome to the Florida Specifier Podcast. From Marco Island, I'm Brett Cyphers, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ryan Matthews. If you like what you hear and you want to support the show, please be sure to hit subscribe on whatever platform you use, and don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. If you or your colleagues have an idea for a future Specifier Podcast recording, don't hesitate to reach out to Ryan or myself to discuss it further, because we would love to have you on.
And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the Florida Specifier online at floridaspecifier.com. The Specifier and its website are improving by leaps and bounds, in my humble opinion, so go check it out. Follow along with future changes. Of course, my favorite edition of the paper has just been released. That Marco edition always brings a little extra excitement.
Yeah, and the subscriptions and ratings truly make a difference, and we think you'll enjoy all the ways you can read, watch, listen, and learn from the Specifier right at your fingertips.
As always, thank you for the support. It has been tremendous. It's been a joy to talk to a couple people down here about their listening to our episodes that we put out so far. So it's been a fun ride, and we appreciate it. So Brett, it's been literal hours since we've seen each other. What have you been focused on during this year's conference? Any clients in town? I'm sure not many.
No, none at all. Yeah, I'm kidding, obviously. It's like, you know, it's the Super Bowl of environmental conferences here. And so a lot of clients in town. And so it's one meeting to the next, but that just comes with the territory, right?
It does. You know, I'm always grateful for agency staff that makes the trek down here. I think they get as much out of it as we do. And just the sheer volume of content that happens year over year. I had some first-timers as clients come this year who were blown away in comparison to other national conferences they go to, mm-hmm. with actual material that is worthwhile and something that could be put into place, as opposed to just waxing poetically about this, that, and the other.
Yeah, and I mean, there's that, and we also now we have incorporated, of course, in a busy schedule and all these great things that are going on with the conference itself. We get the to add on recording onto this, which is cool because, you know, I mean, obviously I like doing the show with you, but it's fun to catch other people maybe a little less guarded than they might otherwise be in these conversations, and so I like that part as well. What's your when you come here, because you're an old hand. I'm an old hand, but you are OG. Marco Island, where's your favorite spot?
So, well, I will say before that I'm not as old of a hand as our guest today, but we've got a tradition. I think I've been to probably 32 of the 38, the first one I was 6. The Snook Inn, every year we go to the Snook Inn. This year we got to go to the newly revamped and reconstructed Snook. We went on Sunday at about 5 o'clock, which I can't encourage folks enough to do, because you can walk right in and get a seat and start your cheerfulness a little bit early. But literally every year, I mean, it's unbelievable to think that, you know, my kids are now the same age that I was, and even older at this point, that they're going every year. So
yeah, I like that. This year, I mean, last year, if I remember correctly, you literally left this conference to go to another conference and then came back in the middle of it. Is that right?
Twice I had to go to the same conference in St. Pete for another client while we were here in Marco Island. So it was, you know, nice 8 hours of driving back and forth. But I was thrilled that this year we did not have to do that.
Sorry about that.
No, you're good.
I think some of the things I like about, first of all, location.
Absolutely. You can't.
The other thing is, this is one of the few conferences where it's very family oriented. Everyone brings their spouses and their kids, and the kids look forward to it every year, especially the reception where they get a chance to, you know, it's like locusts going through to get all the treats and all the toys and all that. And so that family atmosphere and the chance to meet each other's spouses and kids, and our kids are playing together and grandkids and all, that makes it such a unique experience, I think.
It really does. It really does. I've seen people that I see once a year for, you know, a decade or two, and it's always here at this conference.
Yeah, and the voice you just heard was our guest today. You want to introduce him real quick?
Absolutely. No, we're thrilled today to welcome Nick Albergo, who's both an engineer with GHD and a professor at the University of South Florida. Welcome to the podcast, Nick.
Thank you.
You know, before we delve into the topic at hand, let's get to know you a little bit more. You've got a wealth of experience and a string of acronyms. And so, you know, certainly, undoubtedly, you are an expert in your field. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, Nick.
I'd be happy to. So I do a lot of expert witness testimony. And so if you think about it, there's probably, 40,000 professional engineers in Florida. I happen to be one of them. And certainly if you're a PE, you already have a certain amount of expertise. But the legal system looks at scientific admissibility differently. So it takes more than just being a professor who, you know, pollutes the minds of the next generation of engineers on his free time and practices. And so what typically happens is you'll find that experts have achieved their highest level within professional organizations where they've received the peer recognition and the vetting of references to receive that status. And then, of course, the difference between attending a conference versus publishing and speaking at the conference and having that in your resume helps a lot. So honestly, if it wasn't for the work I do in litigation, none of that would matter. But as far as my background, I started a firm in 1989 by the name of HSA Engineers and Scientists, grew it to about 400 people, sold it in 2013, went back to, I was a young professor at 21 years old.
Oh, wow.
But as the firm grew, I couldn't do it. So in 2013, I went back to teaching. And then the other cool thing is that one of my interns from HSA became the boss of the Southeast region of the firm I sold to. So he has me back as a senior advisor to just put the mittens on the left and right hands and to help, you know, wherever I can. So I got a great gig right now.
That's super cool to see it come full circle, I'm sure, too. Unbelievable. With someone that you've brought along and mentored in the profession.
I'm so proud of him. His name's Brian Moore. He does a great job.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and I don't want to gloss over this. Before we started recording, you also have like 1,200 children, because we're talking about the conference.
I do. I have 11 kids and 18 grandkids.
Wow. Wow. Are they all here? What's the age range there?
Of which?
Well, start with the children.
The children, I think, are somewhere between 32 or 33 and 22. Eight I had with my wife, and in the middle, we adopted three boys that were down on their luck, and I didn't want them split up in the system. So I brought them home for the weekend, and they stayed 17 years.
Wow.
Nice.
The grandkids, they are young. I think I've got 11 of them here, 8 and under.
That's a lot of virgin strawberry daiquiris by the kiddie pool.
All right. I had to get that part out before we got like really into it. But speaking of scary things, you've got the monster under the bed, which is now outside from under the bed, and it's PFAS, P-F-A-S, and you're going to tell me what this stuff means. Like, we'll get to that part. First of all, how do you pronounce it? And then why are these chemicals so heavily discussed? Like, why is everyone talking about it right now? Not just in Florida, but everywhere.
Yes, yes. Well, the pronunciation is polyfluoroalkyl substances.
Okay.
And that's the global, if you will, term. It includes probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 million different variations when you consider the substances themselves, the salts that can be created from them, and the isomers, which is the, if you remember from chemistry, when things are either opposite each other or on the same side and all that. So, and then from there, it's broken down into some bigger groups. There's the PFOAs and the PFOS, and it goes on from there. I mentioned the PFOA and PFOS because those EPA have specifically targeted more than others, but there's lots of challenges. One is the carbon fluorine bond is one of the strongest in nature, so it just doesn't break down. The other is that it was specifically designed to repel both water and oil, and so it doesn't get impregnated and diluted by anything, whether it be the oil or the water. And so it's very widespread because of its ubiquitous use. And when we talk about ubiquitous use, I'm saying beyond what you might have heard is the AFFF firefighting foams, the companies like DuPont that manufactured this stuff. It hits all of our wastewater treatment plants, all our drinking water plants, our landfills, our plastics industry, our printing industries, dry cleaning, car washes, carpeting, paper and cardboard. There's a reason why the oils in your French fries don't bleed through at the, you know, fast food place. The textile fabrics, Scotch Garden, so forth, leather, carpeting. It's everywhere. Mm. So much so that studies have been done that show 99% of the human population has PFAS in their blood right now.
I read that. Can you tell me, I guess I'm interested in who the other 1% are. Are they like Alaskans or like, where are those 1%?
Well, frankly, they should be studied because I've always argued that, you know, we take the wrong approach to cancer because we focus so much on people that have it as opposed to people that don't. But just to give you an idea, they did a study recently of 101 bottled water brands. And 40 of the 100 had PFAS above what we're supposed to have, okay? So it's literally everywhere, and it makes, and that's why you're hearing so much about it.
So no one is safe, I mean, to hear. And also, I'm sure when these, you know, compounds were created from, you know, the Teflons and everything, people must have thought this was a miracle compound. I mean, you know, it helped in every instance of life almost, and then fast forward 60 years, and, you know, here we are.
Well, it is a miracle compound. I mean, it's an excellent compound for all of its uses. It's just that it doesn't go away. Mm. And as a result, it bioaccumulates in the food web. And since we're apex predators, so to speak, you know, we wind up seeing it as it goes through. But it has so many other impacts to the environment as well. But, you know, if you're going to go down that road, then we can talk about hormones and other things that we're discharging that also have a lot of impact. And so, you know, why, as you mentioned, well, why PFAS? Why aren't we going after, you know, other things? And the reality is that in 2021, EPA published what they called the Strategic Roadmap, PFAS Strategic Roadmap, and it was a commitment to action by 2025. That winds up being important because as all of us, as is the case, we always wait to the end. And now here we are in 2024. And as a result, EPA published an absolute barrage of regulation. And it was rushed. And it wasn't well thought out. Mm. And it is going to take time. But to give you an idea of what it's looked like over this past year.
Please, yeah.
The toxic release inventory has been increased to 196 PFAS. And more importantly, they removed the de minimis clause, which means you can't have any. Mm. But the world has it already. So,
right.
You know, that's kind of crazy. They added 7 more PFAS to the lower thresholds for chemicals of special concern. They subjected 329 PFAS to reporting requirements as significant new sources. That's where all these industries are going to start to get tagged. We have already an unregulated contaminant monitoring rule that we're in the middle of. That's how EPA decides what hits our list, what we call MCLs, or things that have a standard, have a law in drinking water. We're halfway through evaluating 10,000 public water supplies throughout the country, and we're finding PFAS. We're looking at 29 PFAS, which was all we could look for at the time we established that, and of course lithium, because of the electric car boom. And so that's ongoing. We established a national drinking water standard, as you know, for 6 PFAS, including PFOS and PFOA, which are now at 4 parts per trillion. I'll give you an idea of what that is in a second. But we updated the consumer confidence reports that require now that you identify whether you've got this as part of your operations. We've proposed adding 9 more PFAS or 9 PFAS to the hazardous constituents list under RCRA, which is our Haz Waste grandfather laws, which makes a huge difference on how we manage this. Keep in mind, we don't even have a hazardous waste landfill in Florida. You know, all of ours goes to Amelia, Alabama, where it belongs, right? Mm.
Right.
In our stormwater rules, we've changed our stormwater rules. We're in the midst of actually evaluating 400 of the largest wastewater treatment plants for the presence of PFAS in the influent, in the outflow, and in the biosolids. And of course, they're identifying it there. And as part of that, they've asked each of the plants to actually evaluate 10 industrial users, clients, to see what's coming in specifically from them. So you can imagine both our spray fields and our agricultural lands with biosolids spread. I don't know where that's going to go.
Right.
And it's weird because they've decided not only to look at specific PFAS compounds, but to actually look for something called adsorbable organic fluorine, which takes everything into consideration. And that may not be appropriate. You know, that's not all just PFAS. And then the one that everybody's been talking about at the conference, which is that they've added PFOS to the Superfund, CERCLA, hazardous substances list. And they've put together some loose language about how they're going to enforce it. But as you know, as an attorney, with this recent Chevron deference and how we're going to interpret what rules and laws say and so forth, who knows what's going to happen in this regard.
Well, you hit on a couple things there. You know, you talk about MCLs, you talk about drinking water standards at 4 parts per trillion. You know, seemingly, because the substance is everywhere, pretty sure that humans could be classified as hazardous waste facilities at this point. So we might have to amend RCRA in some shape or fashion.
It's true. It's going to hit, just to give you an idea, it's going to hit all the commercial and industrial owners and operators who become aware that they've got PFAS in their soil or their groundwater. There's going to be directives that are going to come out of EPA and the state, because we're going to talk, I assume, briefly about the state at some point about possibly cleaning up PFAS. And of course, we don't really have good ways to do that. The DOT is going to have to worry about its placarding and its transportation on our highways with this stuff. We've got voluntary cleanup programs that require reporting that are going to have to be addressed.
Yeah, I mean, talk about that for a minute. It's like, well, I mean, now that I'm trying to, you know, lift myself out of this deep depression over what we're talking about. But do talk about the remediation mitigation. Like, how you've talked a lot about how it's in everything, and it's hard to separate, and you can't get rid of it, and yet we're talking about remediation and mitigation of it. And so what do we do?
Yeah. To give you an idea, so 4 parts per trillion, that is 1 inch in 16 million miles, or 600 times around the earth. 1 inch in 600 times around the earth. That's what we're talking about as the MCL.
Yeah, my feeble attorney mind.
Well, no one can fathom that. I mean, what are we doing here, right? So we can filter it using carbon. Of course, what are we going to do with the carbon afterwards? Well, it's a whole nother issue, right? We can use ion exchange like we do our water softeners at home, right, with some zeolites. Of course, what are we going to do with the zeolites? We can use reverse osmosis, but, you know, reverse osmosis works fine under your sink, but we're not doing 30 MGD plants, you know,
not
with
well.
Reverse osmosis.
It's been expensive and a little clumsy,
right.
With less than 30 MGDs.
So, and that's if you pull it to the surface. If we're talking about groundwater, now we're really limited. I mean, we could put in a reactive wall in the ground, I guess, to slow it up. We could solidify, maybe, right? Turn it into concrete, the ground. But we don't have reasonable ways to do it. And if you want to get into, you know, incineration, really high temperature incineration, what's the cost? I mean, there's no way we can economically look at doing that. And that's what I mean by these things have been really rushed. It's fine to pass regulation that we should do something, but, and this I think is one of the things Matt Leopold, earlier in this conference, he was the general counsel for EPA, and he did a talk, was fantastic, by the way, he'd make a great interview, but he talked about the fact that when the federal government promulgates rules, if there is no stay by a judge, that rule is in effect. You got to file it whether you like it or not. People can actually file lawsuits, but that doesn't mean that everything stops.
Right.
And so this train has left the station, and we have no idea how we're going to manage it.
Well, I remember it's like you were, I think you were actually in charge of it at the time at DEP talking about human health criteria, weren't you? Yeah, I mean, we had the list of all the terrible, nasty things that are out there. And we then the process of changing it to reality was met with not a welcome, warm reception, was it?
My first interaction with these substances was actually Paula Cobb coming into my office and sort of giving me a dissertation about what they were, how scary they were, and how nobody really knows what they are now because they were simply contaminants of emerging concern on the EPA website. And once you really, and again, and I'm not an engineer, I'm not a scientist, but yeah, you go down that rabbit hole, and my goodness.
One of the challenges is we need to take a risk-based approach as opposed to a hazard approach. Right now, the way we promulgate these kinds of regulations is we look at what's called a 1 in a million excess cancer risk over the 1 in 3 of us that get cancer anyhow. I mean, let's just break that into simple stuff. There's been an accident at an intersection. People call the DOT and say, we need a light. Well, the DOT doesn't do anything because it's been an accident. But now there's been 6 accidents and 4 deaths. Now DOT decides that's enough risk, unacceptable risk, that we should put a light there. Well, I kind of see we're going to have to do the same thing. Maybe, I know people don't like the idea, but maybe we got to move off 1 in a million excess risk. And maybe we got to accept 10 in a million excess risk. And move these numbers by an order of magnitude, because what else can we do? And so I think ultimately one of the solutions is we're going to have to examine a risk-based solution.
So you talked a little bit about, you know, potential treatment, right? And I think every drinking water facility is going to have to grapple with this in the coming decade. If there are additional treatments that are utilized, costs get passed down to consumers, right? But not only from a potential increase in utility bills for Floridians, who is the responsible party? You know, I mean, from a litigation standpoint, you've got manufacturers, right, who have placed this substance mm-hmm. everywhere. You've got the federal government who's utilized it on military bases and airports and state governments and local governments. You know, everyone wants to look for someone to blame, but it's so pervasive. How do you even kind of wrap your head around that?
Well, of course, I'm preaching to an attorney, but this is why CERCLA is such an inappropriate regulation for what I call a diffuse anthropogenic pollution. Something that's everywhere that was man-made. CERCLA's always been, CERCLA is, if you touched it, you own it. The liability is strict, joint and several, and mm-hmm. retroactive. So let's take just a simple example of biosolids. I mean, think about how many people have touched that biosolids from generation to the wastewater plant, through the plant, treated it. Now it's on some agricultural land as a spray field or biosolids or whatever, right? Under CERCLA, everyone would be responsible. Everyone would be liable. And so it's just a very poor use of CERCLA. It's just not the right regulation to manage this.
From the attorney's perspective, I mean, obviously, I think DuPont, are they the only manufacturer?
No, they're not.
All right. So you have DuPont and a bunch of others. Like how, from the actual lawyer's perspective, like, is that even approachable in terms of dealing with that liability when it doesn't even stop with the manufacturer?
You've got multiple class actions being litigated currently, and some have paid out. DuPont recently, I believe, settled to the tune of, you know, $10 billion plus, right? But that it's the hyperbolic drop in a bucket, quite frankly, when you look at it. Because we were on a panel yesterday in discussing cleanup, and I think it was Doug Manson who said, you know, you could take the entirety of the state of Florida's budget, which is $117 billion, attribute it all to, you know, PFAS remediation, and it still would not be enough.
There's not enough gold in Fort Knox.
Well, awesome. So how do you see the department handling PFAS, PFOA? We obviously have a petroleum restoration program that exists currently, and its goal is to work themselves out of existence. It doesn't seem like that's necessarily the case here, but would there be a natural follow-up, a similar program that you envision for the state? I mean, what does the state do at this point?
So from what I've heard at the conference, first and foremost, the state is going to take the federal government's lead So the state will, in fact, well, the state has already adopted the MCLs because you have to. It's a federal law. But we don't have other standards, law, so to speak, in Florida. We have guidance concentrations for groundwater and for soil and so forth. But we don't have law. The challenge is that, as I understand, the DEP has till January 1st, 2025, to promulgate some sort of PFAS guidance for groundwater and soil. And here again, you know, that we have very little time left.
And that's all based on the federal standard, though, that you were talking about. It's like, is it downstream of these federal regulations? Or
the feds have established MCLs for drinking water only. But if you think of it, and we've talked about it. So, all right, so we can filter at the drinking water plant before it goes in. Okay, but what are we going to do about all the PFAS in the groundwater, which we treat as drinking water, right?
Yes.
And the soil, right? And so these things the state has to address. The federal government isn't in that business right now, okay? So the state will have to decide. Now, the state has proposed something. They got 70 parts per trillion for groundwater. They've proposed some things for soil as well, for both commercial, industrial, residential purposes. It's left to be seen what they're going to do about that. But they're going to have to make a decision here within the next 6-7 months.
From a drinking water standard and facility standpoint, Nick, do you see this as potentially pushing us sort of quicker to that direct potable reuse type of regulatory scheme? I mean, if you're going to have advanced treatment anyway, right? It seems as if your water processing facility and your wastewater facility just become one effectively.
Absolutely. There's no question. And we needed to go that way anyhow. We're running out of water, right? We have such a limited amount. If you ever remember from college, you know, they talk about the cycle. And if you look at this small sliver of fresh water versus seawater and non-potable water and so on, there just isn't enough. You know, talk to California and that whole area. Look at the fight between Florida, Alabama, and Georgia over water, right? It's at our doorstep already, so maybe it pushes us that way a little bit. But to get back to your question about petroleum, here again, the challenge is petroleum has a source, right? We say, okay, let's get the depots, let's get the gas stations, right?
Right.
So we know where it is. We don't have a source per se. It's everywhere. So I don't know. You really can't have a similar program.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that certainly makes sense. But it just makes it that more challenging. And I mean, to your point about water, it's like most of the water that people drink and most of the water that people put on plants to grow them for us to eat comes from the Florida aquifer, which is groundwater. And so dealing with that from, you know, moving forward is like there's going to be a lot of folks busy trying to solve that problem. And it's just wondering how that plays out from the state's perspective.
This is a fact because I've worked on jobs. It's in our Florida aquifer already.
Can I ask a dumb question, perhaps? When you look at potential solutions, and we do in smaller amounts here in Florida, desalination of seawater, is cost aside, is it a safer source in terms of what we're talking about with PFAS than groundwater at that point?
Well, of course, this gets back to risk, right?
Right.
And what your interpretation of
safe
is. RO is an excellent means of filtration at the nanoscale. Keep in mind, we're talking about extremely high pressures on membranes. To try to scale it is just, at this point, it's cost prohibitive. The Saudis do it. To give you an example, they've got, you know, they have half of all the RO plants are in Saudi Arabia, but they also got an unlimited supply of money, right? But keep in mind, what are you going to do with the brine? What are you going to do with the waste from the RO?
Yeah. I mean, the use for OAs in Florida is something like 6 billion gallons of water a day, I think, maybe between there and 7 billion. And so the idea, I mean, I think we even mentioned it earlier, the biggest, best desal plant we have probably produces less than 25 MGD.
That's correct.
And so the idea that you would meet all of it, even if, for me, it's, I think in round, green, perfect world terms and then back your way off to, you know, all the way down to reality. But if the regulations are what they are in these standards, and you're saying, and you know, happen to agree that you look at something based on risk, is like, well, what if we don't get to choose that from a Florida perspective? And that's kind of where I'm thinking. It's like, what do you do?
Keep in mind, you know, from a practical standpoint, even if you had RO plants, they got to go down sometime. What are you going to tell people to stop flushing the toilet and don't drink any water for the next 2 weeks?
Right. And then to your point about the end product, I don't think Floridians would be happy with a couple million deep injection wells everywhere, because you'd have to have, you know, God knows how many.
Yeah.
In fact, I think we've recently stopped even doing class 3 injection, let alone class 1.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, it's here again, what it really comes down to is a rushed and poorly thought out system. And really, that's, again, getting back to these cases that have come up against the Safe Drinking Water Act and Superfund. Matt had mentioned a number of strategies, and the first one comes from Section 102A of CERCLA, which apparently has never actually been used before. This is the first time. But what he discussed was the idea that there's really two prongs to evaluating, you know, what gets put into a regulation. It has to do with substantial danger and exposure. And one of the arguments they're making is that they didn't do a good job of linking those two. We understand there's a danger, but show us how that ties to exposure, especially with things that are mobile, that are long-lived and so forth. You know, where do you draw the line? And then they didn't consider cost. And supposedly, and again, this is more on the legal front, but apparently it's appropriate in these regulatory processes. One of the elements is you're supposed to consider cost. They didn't do that because it was so rushed. You had mentioned something about, could we do it like petroleum? Well, if you don't have a source and you're using a regulation that says you're liable if you touched it, that, you know, prima facie, right? It doesn't make any sense. And then it was never subjected to peer review, to scientific peer review, which typically we do. All of those things were circumvented in an effort to meet the 2025 deadline. And so that's the approach they're going to use to challenge these regulations. However, as we mentioned earlier, that's fine, but in the interim, life is moving forward with regulation as it sets today.
Man, it is some pretty heady stuff. Before we let you get out of here, I do want to ask a little bit about the work you're doing with USF as you're addressing, as you mentioned, the emerging engineering minds of the future. Hopefully it's a little rosier with you know, butterflies and unicorns. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing at USF.
USF is involved with PFAS, especially the St. Pete branch of USF, where they've been doing studies in the bays and Hillsborough Bay and Tampa Bay, 29 fish species, and they're finding PFAS, especially in those that are more associated with the sediments, you know, at the bottom and so forth. They're also finding some transgender nuances that hadn't been noticed before with populations where you have a male dominant fish with a lot of with a female and then a lot of juveniles. And if the male dies, one of the juveniles becomes a man, you know, type thing. Well, we're seeing more feminization as a result of the hormones and everything being discharged. So it's not just PFAS that is having an impact. So USF's been involved in that in their Bayborough campus. And, you know, that's a whole nother talk, and it wouldn't be me.
Wow.
You know, it'd be someone that's a lot smarter than me in that area. But what we're seeing where I work is projects, really good, well-meaning projects, are getting slowed up or stopped. And a great example is two extremely, extremely large international companies. One has a problem with their wastewater because one of the things that's happening in Florida is they're concerned about the TDS, the total dissolved solids, in spray fields and that impact on groundwater, ground to groundwater. So they need to find another place for their wastewater, okay? I find another company that says, we think we can actually use that. If that's the problem, TDS, we think we could use that as part of our air pollution control system for our scrubbers. Win-win. It's a beneficial reuse of a waste. And in doing so, we don't have to use groundwater. We don't have to use our wells. Huh. Perfect. It's a win-win for everybody. Until the ugly, as you mentioned, the ugly giant in the room approaches. And once you talk about the PFAS and CERCLA and what does that mean, who knows?
Wow. Well, Nick, this was fascinating. I think I'm in desperate need of a Miami Vice with a rum floater at this point. We can't thank you enough for coming on. Thank you for the work you do, not only at GHD, but also at USF as well. But that's all the time we have for this episode. Thank you for listening to the Florida Specifier Podcast. Production of this podcast is by Carl Sorn and David Barfield at Lonely Fox Studios. A special thank you goes out to Bagels and Biscuits, who were kind enough to let us use their music for the show. Check them out wherever you get your music.
If you have an idea for an article for the Specifier or a topic for this podcast, please be sure to let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Join us next time as we continue to delve into the issues, policy, and people that environmental professionals and policymakers want to know about. For Ryan Matthews, I'm Brett Cyphers. We'll see you next time.